Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey folks, Zach Ostman here, IU Insider, Indianapolis Star. He is Dustin Dupirak, IU Insider, Bloomington Herald Times. It is a rainy Wednesday, Thursday, May 5th, and it's the off season. And the genesis of this podcast, Dustin, is I was talking to a good friend of ours, Nick Bumgardner, who's covered Michigan for the Detroit Free Press and The Athletic, now does a lot of NFL stuff, about a podcast he was farming out ideas for. And I suggested this to him, and then I used a four-letter word, and I said, no, never mind. I'm going to use that. I'm going to do that podcast myself. This is, I don't know what we'll call it yet, maybe the Wayback Machine for old Rocky and Bullwinkle fans. Looking back at the 2012-13 Big Ten basketball season, and I kind of like the idea of every once in a while, I know, you know, Dustin, when we do kind of retrospective stories and the one or two podcasts we've done, people enjoy them. I like the idea of doing something a little bit more offbeat. You worked for the Herald Times at that time. I worked for 24/7 Sports. We both covered that season. It was obviously intensely anticipated in Bloomington, but it was also, I think, hands down the best Big Ten basketball season I have ever seen. And I'm really looking forward to getting back into it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I did not know exactly where we were going to go with all of this, but I mean, just looking back and remembering some of those teams, I mean, like, you know, the Michigan team that plays in the final was the fifth seed, I think, in the Big Ten tournament. And that tells you a lot about just how loaded it was. I mean, you had a really good Ohio State team. You had a really good Michigan State team. You had a, you know, solid, steady Wisconsin team and some other ones down the line that were some that didn't perform as well as expected. But I mean, it was loaded. There was depth. They ended up with somebody on every seed line from 1 to 5 in the NCAA tournament. It was it was some kind of year, and it was you know, I think there was a reason why. Obviously, we talk a lot about how Indiana handled winning the Big Ten championship, but there was a reason why they took a lot of pride in winning it outright in the regular season.
You mentioned there everybody, you know, a number, like at least one team on the seed line 1 through 5. It's also the only season in KenPom's team-wide database, which dates back to the 2001-2 season, in which 5 Big Ten teams made the top 12 in the final KenPom rankings. There were 6 in the top 20, if you include Minnesota. If you go into the actual Big Ten that season, I mean, it's wild how loaded it was. They put 7 teams in the Big Ten tournament, or excuse me, the NCAA tournament. An 8th team, Iowa, actually lost to Baylor in the NIT finals. That's a Minnesota team that has – that's Tubby Smith's Minnesota with Andre Hollins, Rodney Williams, Trevor Mbakwe, Austin Hollins. That's undeniably John Gross's best Illinois team. Obviously, Indiana fans will remember Indiana losing on that buzzer beater at Illinois in – what was that? That was early February. Brandon Paul, Tracy Abrams, DJ Richardson, of course, the one that Indiana fans might rue remembering, Tyler Griffey. But then you get to the top of that conference, and I mean, it's fascinating kind of both looking back the season before, I guess, to start, and then looking at the season after. The season before, I believe, if my research is correct, is the only other season where the Big Ten has at least 4 teams in the top 10 of the final KenPom rankings. And so there is, you know, that's Indiana, Wisconsin, Michigan State, Ohio State. And I think Indiana, Michigan State, and Ohio State in particular were very much kind of, you know, sort of a piece coming out of that season. Obviously, Indiana's number 1 overall, but that's an Ohio State team that's in the Final 4. That's a Michigan State team that's going to wind up returning Keith Appling, Derek Nix, Brandon Dawson, Adrian Payne, Travis Trice. Like there's a lot of you can see Michigan State kind of building another one of their big classes, and obviously also Gary Harris coming in that year as a freshman. Michigan was a little bit further outside, I think largely because they lost in the first round of the NCAA tournament in 2012. They lost to VCU. But going into that season, you can certainly see it shaping up as a big season at the top. And then, and this is an Indiana-centric podcast, so maybe I won't get in trouble for saying this. I recognize how it sounds. But I think in particular, it's a Big Ten that you know is going to be really good. And you also, there's an added layer of hype around it because Indiana's number one overall in the preseason. And the question that the Big Ten had been asking itself for 20 years, 15, 20 years, was when would it get vintage Indiana back? This was vintage Indiana carrying the standard for what certainly feels like the most difficult Big Ten I've ever seen.
Yeah, I mean, it especially in retrospect, I mean, I still think that there's sort of remnants of that season that carry, but I mean, my God, like, and just from our perspective, I remember feeling like the hype never ended. You know, I mean, I remember we talk a lot about where it felt like the 2011-12 season never ended for Indiana, never ended for us. It sort of just felt like we were on a constant stream when it came to news stuff, but also just feeling like, oh man, like the whole college basketball, you know, media world is going to descend on this because everybody's been sort of waiting for this kind of Indiana team for such a long time. And you knew that, you know, Sports Illustrated, it, you know, not at its peak, but basically a powerful Sports Illustrated was going to come to town. USA Today was going to come to town. ESPN was going to come to town. Basically everybody was going to be there trying to, you know, write big stories because you had, and you know, they were vintage, and it was Cody Zeller being this sort of poster child for everything, having had a great freshman year and going into sophomore year as sort of the consensus, you know, preseason national player of the year. Didn't end up actually winning player of the year, but, you know, it still had a terrific year, and it felt like a mild disappointment because he wasn't that, but he was close. And so there was, everybody was sort of circled around that. But yeah, I mean, you saw the other teams, the other pieces, but it was just like people had been waiting for this kind of Indiana team for a long time. And, you know, just clearly descended upon that and had so much reason to, you know, just because they had beat the national champion Kentucky team the previous year, given them a terrific game in the Sweet 16 that year in Atlanta. There was a lot of draw. And there were great teams that lost players. I mean, Ohio State ends up being really good in 2013, but had lost some spectacular talent, you know, that season. I think, I can't remember if that was Sullinger's year or not. Yeah, I think it was. Or actually, no, I'm wrong about that. But, you know, lost William Buford, lost some really, you know, like Ohio State had been loaded a couple years prior, but still had enough pieces of that with Aaron Kraft and Deshaun Thomas coming back. Like there were all these good pieces around, but everybody was really just focused and centered on Indiana in that offseason.
I want to start with, like, we'll zero in on Indiana, but I want to start with the league. It gets a boost when Trey Burke decides to come back. I think Tim Hardaway Jr. may have also tested the draft process that year. In hindsight, that Michigan team is ridiculously talented. Caris LeVert is on that team. They've got two freshmen who are future lottery picks. At least I think Glenn Robinson III was a lottery pick. Nick Stauskas was. Who are both like involved, like between, I mean, Glenn Robinson had 292 shot attempts that season. Nick Stauskas had over 300, but in the, or maybe like maybe 298, if I'm doing my math right. But from a usage perspective, they were very much role players kind of next to Trey Burke, Tim Hardaway. Mitch McGarry came on kind of into the previous season, into that season. And then, I mean, you look around, like there's some other fascinating like stories. Like again, Gary Harris at Michigan State, Brandon Dawson at Michigan State, that Keith Appling at Michigan State, which obviously is a story kind of unto itself. And just sort of where, you know, where things have gone for him after college. And then even kind of looking at like Wisconsin, because Wisconsin, we would not have realized that. That was a Wisconsin team that, like every Bo Ryan team, they won 20 games. They finished in the top 4 or 5 at the conference. They went 12-6. We did not have a sense, though, of the degree to which Wisconsin was the coming force in the Big Ten at that time. Like Frank Kaminsky was a sophomore. And again, like, he took 98 shots that season. It wasn't like Frank Kaminsky was coming out of nowhere. Sam Decker was even more involved than that. He played all 35 games as a freshman. I want to say he started a small handful of them. But that Wisconsin team, really, it had the building blocks that would wind up, I would argue, maybe producing a couple years later, maybe the best team the Big Ten has seen in the last 10, 15 years. Again, you even go all the way down to like a team like Iowa, which did not even make the NCAA tournament that season. A bit remarkable considering, I think they were 31st in KenPom when the season ended. They were 9-9 in the conference. They had a couple bad losing streaks and I think basically just didn't, I'm guessing looking at their schedule, didn't do enough in the non-conference, but they were a 21-win team that finished 500 in the Big Ten, and they wound up in the NIT that year. But, I mean, that was an Iowa team with Roy Devin Marble, Aaron White, Mike Giselle. I assume probably Jordan Bohannon was in there somewhere because I think he was in college for 2 or 3 years by that point. Like, that was just – that was – we would have gone into that season saying this is a really talented league. But I don't think we appreciated until we got into the season and until you started seeing, like – and I'm looking at this particularly through the Indiana lens, but like when Minnesota came to Indiana on January 9th and Indiana led that game big and almost lost it. You think about, you know, games against Michigan, games against Michigan State. That season, it just felt, particularly in February and early March, like every game was a heavyweight fight. And we would have known that league was going to be so talented going into that year when you went roster by roster and you saw Burke and Zeller and Oladipo and Harris and, you know, Payne and you know, whoever else. We can go on and on with these names, Mbakwe, whoever. But, like, the way the league shaped up, it was just every night it felt like you were going to go all 12 rounds with whoever you were playing. As long as you were playing one of those – you know, five or six, or maybe even all the way down to like 8 or 9 kind of in the conference standings.
I think when you think about some of the list of players, and I think what that season also was too, was like, this is sort of, you know, Kentucky had just climbed the mountain, you know, the previous year. And obviously you had this whole the discussion of the one and done phenomenon and where this was going and how this was going to change. College basketball and whether it was going to lead to, you know, this notion that there were going to be these superpowers that were just going to run through five NBA players every year and that they were just going to, you know, wipe, you know, just crush everybody else. And that Big Ten season was in a sense that, like, there was some level of like provided some kind of like counter argument.
Refuted a lot of
combination. What's that?
He refuted a lot of that when you looked at not just the experienced players you had, but like Cody Zeller probably would have been a lottery pick. Burke would have been a draft pick, like the guys that came back.
Mm-hmm. And the guys that came back and even the guys that were new, like the Big Ten was able to create a phenomenal overall league-wide freshman class based largely on players that, you know, came from that footprint. More or less. And I'm, you know, and almost everybody got a big one. I mean, obviously Indiana's class, freshman class that year ends up being, you know, grossly overrated. And I personally had a lot to do with, you know, making guys out to be a lot better than they ended up being, you know, Hanna Perea especially, but everybody kind of got somebody again from that footprint, whether it was from, you know, your state or not. It was relatively local and it was this more, it was sort of organic roster building in the sense that you think of it of going, getting great players that are within your footprint or within your region and turning that into, you know, a great all around roster and keeping guys for 3 or 4 years. Cause they're not all, you know, one and done quality NBA talent, but, you know, are worth sticking around. I mean, obviously I think Gary Harris ends up being a one and done, but you didn't necessarily know he was going to be that going in. You knew he was a big deal.
I think he was two and done.
Top 25. What's up?
I think he was 2 and done.
Oh, did he do 2 years? Okay.
Pretty sure he did 2 years.
Regardless, Gary was obviously a big deal, but and Indiana wanted him bad, basically. You know, certainly was one of the best guys in that class, ends up being, I think, you know, Mr. Basketball, beating Yogi out by a little bit. But it again, you look across that board and you think about how much the 2011 and 2012 classes in the state of Indiana drive that and make a lot of teams better. I mean, Glenn Robinson's was a Gary guy, Mitch McGarry up from Chesterton. A lot of those pieces end up becoming a driving force, you know, for not just Indiana, but the whole league. I mean, Deshaun Thomas, obviously a Fort Wayne guy, ends up being, you know, a star that year, ends up being a first team All Big Ten player. You know, Zeller and Farrell and obviously Jordan Halls, you know, help drive Indiana. But there's a lot of these pieces all come together, but it's also this, you know, again, sort of counter argument for you can still build it the, you know, somewhat traditional way of, you know, again, recruiting within your geographic footprint within your state and within slightly they're out and being able to keep guys around and get them to play together and turn those into great teams and not feeling like you have to, not everybody has to follow the Kentucky model to win. It at least was what was the Kentucky model at the time. So I think that's sort of fascinating where the league as it was that year, you know, stands in, you know, sort of provides a counter narrative, a counterbalance to where college basketball was going. And you did know coming in, you know, you looked at all these pieces that were these teams that were pretty good off of what they previously had and then how much they bolstered themselves. Again, you mentioned Sam Decker, and I think he's a fascinating piece for me because I think he really takes Wisconsin to a next level where you had seen these sort of standard steady Wisconsin teams that had, you know, a big man, some guards that could shoot and guys that played defense and kept it to low possessions. You know, Decker gets you an athlete that we hadn't seen at Wisconsin yet. And I think he ends up being what makes that, you know, as good as Kaminsky was, and as Kaminsky was the best player on that team in 2015. I mean, Decker adds an element that Wisconsin had not had. Up until that point, there were other guys that were like Frank Kaminsky in the past, basically that might not have been as good as he ended up being, but were, you know, had similar skill sets. Sam Decker is sort of a unique player in Wisconsin history, and so there's pieces like that throughout the league. I think that are fascinating just in terms of the way rosters were built.
It's also interesting to me going back through the KenPom numbers again. Indiana's conference strength of schedule, according to Kim Pomeroy, was ninth in the conference. They are one of only three teams in the last 15 years to win at least a share of the conference title with a single-digit strength of schedule. And the two teams right behind them, Ohio State and Michigan State, who tied for second, were eighth and third. And normally, at the top end of the conference, you'll see some double-digit numbers next to some of those teams. Not at all the time, but essentially like, for example, Indiana in 2016 had the 13th ranked conference strength of schedule per Kim Pomeroy, and the team that finished second, Michigan State, it was 14th. And then, you know, the conventional wisdom is basically if you don't play each other twice, you can't play yourselves. So you're losing a little bit of, you know, what you need to boost your strength of schedule. But like, it was so rugged that year. And if you go back and look through some of the individual results, like, I think Indiana fans probably still think about that loss from time to time against Illinois. But like, I mean, Ohio State, a team that was one win from was a 4-point loss away from a Final Four for, I think, the second straight year. Ohio State lost by 19 at Illinois. I mean, that's an Illinois team that I think finished eighth in the conference that year, and they still beat Gonzaga. They still beat Butler. Like, when, I mean, this was, you know, sort of, you know, post 10 and 11 afterglow Butler that was still competing at the top end of, you know, whatever conference it was in and all this. I mean, that Butler team went to the NCAA tournament out of the Atlantic 10, not even out of the Horizon, but Illinois beat Gonzaga. It beat Butler. It beat Indiana. It beat Ohio State. It beat Minnesota twice. And again, that's a Minnesota team that goes to the NCAA tournament. That's maybe Tubby Smith's best Minnesota team. Certainly felt like his toughest Minnesota team. I mean, if it was his best, I don't know, but he was one of only two that finished or one of only three that finished 500 in the Big Ten. Actually, no, it didn't. Forgive me. It did not finish 500 in the Big Ten. Minnesota went 8-10 and still made the NCAA tournament. I think won a game in the end. They did. They beat UCLA. I mean, it just like everywhere there were just, again, there were like just, there were no easy games. And to kind of bring this around to Indiana, or a few easy games, there were a handful of easy games, like, you know, Nebraska wasn't very good and et cetera. But to kind of bring it around to Indiana, like, I can remember conversations that I've had with IU, you know, people that were around the program that year, who basically just said later that it wasn't all of what went wrong in 13-14 the year following, but part of what happened to Indiana in 13-14 was the emotional hangover of 2013 and just how much of a grind. You said like it felt like the hype never stopped. It never felt like there was an off season for that team. Like it never felt like there was a time where that team could just go away and recharge its batteries from the night they lost to Kentucky in Atlanta all the way through to the night they lost to Syracuse in Washington. It was like the two seasons were just almost melted into one. And I think emotionally, you know, we've heard a lot about guys who were banged up, and I think Jordan Hall's had a shoulder injury nobody knew about. Some other guys were nursing some things by March of 2013. But like people I've talked to around the program then said that like emotionally, mentally, they were just, everyone was exhausted. And I think that really, it's not to, you know, people always want to know like what's to blame for Indiana losing to Syracuse and all that. I mean, I've always felt a little bit like Indiana just, there was an extent to which, because that experience was so new for almost everyone on that roster, up to and including its coach, and I'm not criticizing Tom Crean at all. This was his first experience having a team that was, you know, top 1, 2, 3 in the country in the preseason, those kinds of expectations, and how to manage them and how to deal with all that noise. I think everybody was just so tired by the end of the season. And I think it was in some way to their credit that they got at least one of those titles over the line.
Yeah, no, I think absolutely. I mean, I think they had developed a sense, and I remember talking to, I remember we talked to Tim Buckley about something, and I'm trying to remember what it was. And I remember being in, they had us in the film room. It might have been like postseason or whatever. I think he was annoyed at there was like a Wall Street Journal article that basically said Indiana had underachieved more than any team simply for the fact that Cody Zeller and Vic Oladipo end up being lottery picks. But basically, like, they were the first team to have, you know, two top five picks or whatever and not get past the Sweet 16 or something along those lines. And saying that this was this grand underachievement. And they really took issue with that because it was like, well, we won the Big Ten. We won one of the best leagues we've ever seen. You know, yeah, we took a one and done loss in a single elimination tournament against Syracuse, and that's a disappointment. But calling this team a disappointment is deeply unfair considering, you know, what it achieved. But it really was like that. I mean, once it hit Big Ten season, it was a grind all the time. But it already been a grind. It was just when they got to non-conference that they just had so much juice from the offseason, you know, which is when the season started. I mean, you could just tell they were playing at a higher level than everybody else. And, you know, they – and the night that I realized that they were really – like, you knew from the hype, but, like, when we realized, I think we weren't faking, was when, like, we weren't making stuff up and just, you know, saying, well, we're not used to seeing good teams. When they blitzed North Carolina at the Big Ten ACC, and I like, that's one you still remember because, like, they were playing on fast forward when North Carolina was on maybe on play, you know, and it was just – they were at a different speed at a different level. And, you know, that just – we hadn't seen that. You know, we hadn't seen something like that from those guys as good as they were the previous year. They were just so far advanced. I mean, like, North Carolina did not have an answer, like, at all. You know, and it's North Carolina, and I'm trying to remember who was on that team.
I think starting lineup in that game for North Carolina, the starting lineup in that game was James Michael McAdoo, Marcus Page, Dexter Strickland, Reggie Bullock, and Desmond Hubert, but Hubert only played 7 minutes. They also brought Leslie McDonald, Bryce Johnson, Joel James, and J.P. Tokoto. Was it Tokoto or Tokoto?
Yeah, I can't remember.
For double-digit minutes.
Yeah, they had dudes. Indiana, like, that wasn't the best Carolina team you've seen, but they had dudes, and North Carolina, or like, Indiana just ran away.
E.J. Harrison didn't play. North Carolina's largest lead was by 1 point with 9.5 minutes left. And if you look at, like, the win expectancy graph on KenPom, Indiana's win expectancy does not dip below like 93% the entire second half.
Jeez. No, it was absurd. I mean, it was totally wild just how fast that got out of hand. I mean, how fast they could play, how good they were in transition. The extent to which they could just run over somebody, you know, was wild. And again, run over a team that traditionally, and that season, has a ton of athleticism, has dudes. Reggie Bullock is still in the league. You know, I mean, like they had just an absurd, like a lot of sort of physical athletic talent, and Indiana ran away from them. And so you saw that, but it was just like eventually the grind really hits. In January, I think a big part was, I mean, there was such a high bar for them to hit, where even the rest of the teams in the league were used to being pretty good, and they didn't feel like this is the year where it absolutely must happen. Where it was like, okay, Michigan State could feel like, okay, we were good last year, we're going to be good next year, we're going to be good the year after that. Ohio State still had some sense of that. I think Indiana goes into that year, you know, not thinking that they're never going to be good again, but thinking this is the year where it absolutely has to happen, because you know you're losing Cody. You know, you know he's going to be a top 10 pick at worst. As the year goes on, you figure out Oladipo is going to go too. You know, I think an early part of the season, you might not think that. You might think you got a chance at a senior year from Vic. But, you know, really early on, you think he's going to be a first round pick. And obviously went toward the end of the season when he starts playing like national.
Yeah, I think they thought because they oversigned by three that year. And I think they did it partly because they knew by the end of the season, Vic was going to be. I mean, he was already trending that way. He had a better sophomore year than I think people remember, because that junior year is everyone's overriding memory. But I think that staff knew where he was going, that he had kind of – he'd found an outside shot. He was going to be able to handle the ball more. He was going to have two point guards that could set him up. I think it was less the guys they thought they would lose and more just that it felt like it needed to be a season that paid off everything Indiana had done. Like, Indiana had torn it down to the studs in an effort to just, like, start over and just go, you know, just go from zero all the way back up. And it felt like it could not have culminated any more perfectly than it did. And it was somewhat about knowing you were going to lose some of those guys. Holes was going to graduate. Watford was going to graduate. Zeller, Oladipo would leave. But it was also more about this idea that, like, this is the opportunity to justify all of that and to legitimize all of that. Everything that we asked the fan base to go through for 4 years, here in year five, it's all going to pay off.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think one connected to that, I think, is the way that the end of the Big Ten season gets handled, something that people aren't going to forget, you know, especially cutting down nets after beating Ohio State. Or not beating, after losing to Ohio State on senior night, is still something I think that IU fans are, I still don't know how to process. It was one of the wildest things to watch. It was probably one of the stranger nights we spent at Assembly Hall, because when that game ended, we didn't talk to Tom Crean until what, 1:30 in the morning?
1:47 a.m. was when he came into the room.
1:47 a.m. It was one of the strangest evenings, because, I mean, you have, they cut down nets, Jordy Halls and Christian Watford give speeches. Jordy Halls gives a phenomenal speech. But I remember talking to you. I remember, and you might have even written this, or I remember having this conversation, that you had the sense that it sort of reminded you of training for Little Five and tapering, and basically that they had already peaked and that there was no coming back from it.
There was one game, and Zoom is going to chop us off here in a minute. We got 9 minutes. I guess we should ask somebody at some point if we can pay for Zoom Pro, because they're certainly getting a lot more difficult about this. They had a game that year that they won. It was at home against Iowa. They won 73-60. But Jordan Halls went 0-4, and Christian Watford went 0-2 from behind the three-point line. And I just remember thinking, Halls is actually 0-7 from the floor that day overall. Mm-hmm. And Watford, now that I look at it, was 0-8. And I remember watching that and just thinking, like, these guys are missing shots that have been automatic for the last 2 years. Like, yeah. They were They were open shots, open threes, and they were in the spots that you knew these guys were like comfortable getting their shots. And I just remember thinking, like, because I think the peak of that season is when they beat Michigan State, or when they beat Michigan, then they lose to Illinois. But actually, because the league is so tough, then they go beat Ohio State and actually either stayed steady in the ranking despite losing or went up like one spot. Then they pummeled Nebraska, they pummeled Purdue, and they won at Michigan State on February 19th. And then like they lose at Minnesota, and you can say, okay, well, Indiana loses at Minnesota a lot. That's a tough Minnesota team. I remember that Iowa game. It was March 2nd. It was at home. I think it was a Saturday afternoon. Just looking at them and feeling like this team does not look like it physically. Things are happening on the floor that weren't happening a month ago, 2 months ago. Like, have they broken down a little bit somewhere? And then obviously with the Ohio State game, and I think that's an excellently coached game by Thad Matta, to be fair to him. And Indiana had already clinched a share of the conference title coming into that game because Michigan beat Michigan State over the weekend.
Mm-hmm. That was the thing. It was over the weekend, so they technically clinch a share when they're not playing.
But it all sets up for...
Yeah. They could have won it outright on senior night, and they don't, but they basically, it's just like when we walk off the floor the last time, because we are Big Ten champs, we want to celebrate this because we wanted to be understood that this is a championship team.
And it felt like that.
And
like
be remembered that way.
I don't know if Tom would have done that for the 2016 team. And they did cut down the nets, but they won their last game at home. They beat Maryland. I think he did that for that team because, again, he wanted that to be the manifestation of everything. And like, I understood his point. And I understood why IU fans were frustrated. And I've contended forever that if Indiana came back the next season and went to the Sweet 16, finished third in the Big Ten, won 25 games and went to the Sweet 16, Tom would not have had to wear a lot of what happened in March 2013 the way that he did later in his IU tenure. But like, I understood why Tom wanted that, I think, as much for that team as anyone else.
Yeah.
But it is something that he winds up having to wear. Right. But it also sets up one of the most insane things I've ever seen in college basketball. I was not there. You covered this game in person. I did not. I think we sent Alex McCarthy because he was from Michigan.
It was nuts.
Indiana's largest lead was 10-3. This is at Michigan on Sunday, March 10th, last game of the regular season. Their minimum win probability was 5.8%. They were down 71-66 with 52 seconds left. And then you have all the missed free throws. Michigan probably gets a little bit too lax about basically giving up free points to Indiana, like trying to get them back. And then, I mean, just that whole, like, if Jordan Morgan touched it, then it was probably going in and he touched it out. Yeah. If he didn't touch it, if he had touched it, it probably would have gone in. Like, it was an insane ending to just an insane season. And it felt just
sat on the rim for like half, like it felt like half a second.
Zeller went for 25 and 10 that day. Oladipo was 7-15 from the floor, but he had 13 rebounds and 3 assists. Like, it was, this maybe is over dramatic, but like, it did feel like that team throwing everything it had into one last game.
It looks more so that way in retrospect, because I think they just knew that they needed to win something that was going to stay, and they made it happen. So, but like it was wildness. They were down. It looked like they were going to lose that game. They just gave every ounce they had left, and again, that ball is up on the rim, and it falls sideways, and then it's mayhem. After that, and Tom Crean is calling out Jeff Meyer, and it's just like, I didn't even know what was happening until we got to see video replay of it, because we were obviously coming down from a distance. We just saw like Tom around him and we didn't know what was going on. And then you see the pictures and the video and you're just like, what was this? Like, but no, it was absolutely that team leaving it all out there and feeling like, okay, if we're getting nothing else out of this year, if this is going to end before it's supposed to, then we are at least going to call ourselves champions in some way, and they can never take it away from us. And I just remember that feeling of pride. And I don't know if it was resignation or whatever, but just like, all right, we got this. At the very least, whatever happens after this, we got this. If the wheels are going to come off, we can at least call ourselves champions of something major. We say this is, we won one of the best leagues that we've seen in years. At least we're going to be able to hang this, you know, at least we're going to be able to hang this and say, you know, this team was a Big Ten championship team, even if it didn't ultimately do what it was expected to do when the season started. But no, it was absolutely laying it all on the line. I'm trying to even remember just the sequence of what happens before that layup goes down. But I remember Yogi might have got a finger on it or something like that. But it was, yeah, it was wild how it just stayed up there. And you're like, well, if it goes one way, you know, this is going to just rip Indiana's hearts out. And if it goes another way, Indiana wins. And it obviously they caught that break.
We'll leave the Syracuse game for another day because I suspect that might be the sort of thing we might discuss on another one of these podcasts, but we have about 2 minutes left. I'll ask you first. You know, you mentioned a couple of them there, but like maybe not just specific to Indiana, though I imagine we'll probably both name Indiana games because we covered Indiana and Indiana did win the league that year. Like, what is the one game that is your overriding memory of that season?
I mean, that one, that Indiana-Michigan game, because so much was piled into it. And again, like that's two really, really, really good basketball teams just trading blows throughout. And Indiana had crushed them, you know, had beat them soundly in Bloomington. And one of those memories is
didn't beat them soundly in Bloomington, because that was going to be my That Michigan game was 1-3.
Yeah.
It was the game day game. Indiana won by 8, but like it was tight for Indiana led big early.
Mm-hmm.
But it stayed close for a lot of that.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
A lot. Like, I mean, the second Indiana was ahead by 4 points at halftime, and Indiana won both halves by 4 points.
Yeah.
And actually the middle two quarters of the game, Michigan won 38-27.
That I didn't realize.
I picked it because I couldn't pick the one that I didn't cover that you did. But like people talk about what's the loudest you've ever heard Assembly Hall, the Watford shot, the Killingsworth dunk. I can't think of one specific moment, but I've never heard Assembly Hall louder for a sustained 40 minutes than it was for that game. Because Michigan was number one in the country coming into that game, and Indiana was number three.
Yeah.
And that, like you said, that's such a talented Michigan team. It winds up going on to play for a national championship. Yeah. It was nuts. I mean, it was a crazy season. And, we could go on forever, but Zoom is about to kick us off. Mm-hmm. For Dustin Pirak, I'm Zach Osterman for the Bloomington Herald Times, the Indianapolis Star. This has been the Wayback Machine on Mind Your Banners. We will do this again very soon. Thank you so much for listening.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.